Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
And it's a Thursday. It is July 16th, 2026, the memorial of the Our Lady of Mount Carmel, which is a beautiful spot in Israel near Haifa. If you've ever been, absolutely gorgeous. Lady of Mount Carmel, pray for us. We have a great lineup for you today. Looking forward to talking to our wonderful guest right out of the gate after the news and the weather and all that good stuff. The one, the only, Father Mitch Pacwa with our cultural connections. And Father, with good reason, is very concerned about the election of some of these politicians that aren't even recognizable anymore when it comes to party affiliation. And we're talking about these communistic-type politicians, left to the left to the left to the left of left. And it's very frightening what's happening. So we'll talk about that with Father Mitch in Cultural Connections. And then we're going to take a look at a wonderful new resource for young people, UCAT Love Forever. It's an essential read for anyone seeking to understand the Church's teaching on love and marriage, especially those who are considering marriage. So what a great resource for young people. And our guest will be Emily Dineny, and she is a Catholic influencer. She also works for Catholic Answers. And she runs her own apologetic social media account at Catholic Converts. And she has a built-in audience of more than 100,000 followers across various social media platforms. And she's also shared her conversion story publicly, including an appearance on Fox News during a youth conversion story segment that they were doing. So looking forward to getting the scoop from Emily on this resource and why this is so important for our young people. That's our number one. In our number two and 2 cents, have you ever taken a closer look at our gospel for today, where our Lord talks about my yoke is easy and my burden is light? And what does that mean? What do we mean by that? And I absolutely love this because I did a whole chapter on the yoke and going against the yoke, because I did that for a long time, and the meaning of it in Catholicism and what it represents and what our Lord is referencing when he's giving us that phrase, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Basically, and I'm going to dive into this, it means that when you are joined with him and you accept his will instead of pushing against it, you are going to be able to produce much fruit because you're following in the will of God. We'll explain and we'll give the Catholic meaning behind it as well. That will come up in 2 cents. And then we're also going to be chatting in the second hour with Michael O'Neill, our very own miracle hunter. We're taking a look at the canonization cause for the Nobel Prize winner, Sigrid Undset. Of course, you know Michael. He is a regular on EWTN, a regular on this show. He's also the host of EWTN Radio's Miracle Hunter. And you see him in Explore with the Miracle Hunter and They Might Be Saints, also here on EWTN. So he'll be joining us for 2 segments. Then it'll be exciting to talk about the process of canonization. And we'll also talk about some reading recommendations from Sigrid Undset, especially her book about Catherine of Siena, which was recommended to me by the one, the only, Father John Mercado. So much to discuss today on a Thursday morning edition of Catholic Connection. What's the weather looking like? Well, we still have a lot of issues out there, including wildfire smoke, and we have a lot of heat. And I was telling my producer, Richard, before the program that Deacon Dom and I are getting ready to head back to the States on Monday, after the show on Monday. And we're talking to all our friends, and they're sending us messages. And my one girlfriend, Joyce, wrote me, and she says, I'm looking forward to seeing you, but this is what you're going to be facing when you come back. And she sends me this picture of smog. And Michigan right now is engulfed in all this smog coming to us from Canada because of the wildfires there. And then also we have this problem of this intestinal virus. We are the number one state for this, although they think they're narrowing that down in terms of a possible cause. But Dom says, why are we going back again? Anyway. It's just kind of funny. All right, so the National Weather Service is saying flash flood risk continues in Texas. And then again, wildfire smoke is impacting parts of the country as well. We have widespread, life-threatening, considerable flash flooding expected in south central Texas. And that is through at least tomorrow. Could last a little bit longer, but they're saying at least through Friday. Catastrophic river flooding and rapid rises on small streams, and also some other problems are expected in the Texas Hill Country. We have wildfire smoke impacting air quality, as I mentioned, across much of the Great Lakes region into the Northeast with air quality alerts in effect. And again, we'll have more on the weather stories in our news segment, which is coming up right now. It's 4 minutes past the hour, so let's take a look at the news here on a Thursday morning, July 16th, on EWTN's Catholic Connection. Well, big story out of France that we're following for you. The French National Assembly giving final approval yesterday to a bill legalizing euthanasia and assisted suicide. As EWTNnews.com reports, this makes France one of the few European countries to legalize a practice along with Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Spain. The 291-241 vote coming 3 years after the president, Emmanuel Macron, who had made it one of his key campaign promises, first opened the question to national debate. The vote ending an unusual parliamentary stalemate between the National Assembly and the Senate. Members of the National Assembly passed the bill 3 times over the course of 14 months, most recently late last month, by a vote of 295 to 232, and senators rejected it just as many times. Now, the vote yesterday did not close the matter, however. The council must rule within a month or 8 days if the government asks for an expedited review, meaning the law cannot be promulgated until that review is complete, even though the Assembly has now adopted it. President Trump's pick to oversee the Justice Department was questioned on Capitol Hill yesterday. Senator John Cornyn of Texas pressing Todd Blanche on whether he will go after the makers of the abortion pill.
This ought to be a pretty easy call because women are hurt as a result of side effects.
Senator Cornyn also said if Todd Blanche gets a job, he wants to see an effort to crack down on access to the abortion pill because he says it's dangerous, especially without a doctor's visit.
Incomplete abortion, other complications when this is being sold through the mail.
Blanche, meanwhile, calling President Trump the most pro-life president in history, saying that federal health leaders are taking a hard look at the abortion pills, but he did not go into litigation strategy. Blanche will be back in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee today as it considers his nomination to be the next AG for the United States. New South Carolina Republican Senator Darlene Graham meeting with the president at the White House today. She was appointed to take over the seat of her brother, Senator Lindsey Graham, who died unexpectedly over the weekend. Later in the day, Trump will welcome the president of El Salvador to the Oval Office, and tonight at 9 p.m., he will also be delivering a major address to the nation about election integrity. President Trump is also announcing a large investment in national security as the U.S. conducts new strikes on Iran. He spoke Wednesday at the Pennsylvania Defense and Innovation. Industrial base. Trump saying the state will play a key role in building the arsenal of freedom, as he referred to it. Just before he took the stage, U.S. Central Command announced it had started conducting an additional round of strikes on Iran, Trump reiterating that previous presidents should have taken action with that country. And also another big story we're following for you out of Washington in terms of Iran and Israel. More than 100 House Democrats voting to stop aid to Israel yesterday. That's a huge shift, as Mark Mayfield tells us, in support for the U.S. ally.
An amendment to a State Department funding bill introduced by Republican Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie would have slashed aid for Israel by $3.3 billion. It failed 314 to 104, but left the Democratic Party strongly divided after anger over Israel's conduct in its war with Gaza. Only 37 Democrats voted for a similar measure 2 years ago. I'm Mark Mayfield.
Life-threatening flash flooding, as we mentioned in the weather forecast this morning, pounding parts of Texas. The governor, Greg Abbott, declaring a state of emergency across 59 counties.
We are dealing with and responding to a flood that is likely going to break records in Texas history. Our primary focus right
the
now,
the National Guard,
and throughout the remainder of this torrential rain is saving lives.
The National Guard and other state resources activated ahead of the storms. Dozens of water rescues have been carried out already in hard-hit Uvalde County alone. And the Aspen Acres fire in southern Colorado is now the fifth most destructive wildfire in state history. Incident Commander Jake Livingston says firefighters are working to keep the fire away from more than 200 structures near Lake Isabel and Camp Jackson.
We're making progress, but there's still a lot of potential right now in this fire if the right conditions show up for fire behavior. So a lot of potential to impact homes from Lake Isabel all the way down to Rye.
More than 850 structures, meanwhile, have already been destroyed by that fire, including more than 330 homes. The Aspen Acres fire continued its slow growth this week, moving to just 100,000 acres with 36% containment as of yesterday. That makes it now the seventh largest wildfire in state history in terms of size. The community of Beulah was removed from pre-evacuation status, meanwhile, and the Pueblo County Sheriff's Office is asking all non-residents to avoid the area while residents return to their homes. Michael Kastner tells us wildfires burning in Canada and Minnesota, as we also mentioned earlier, are causing air quality issues across large sections of the country.
The smoke was dense and hazy Wednesday from Minnesota to Michigan and upstate New York and further into the Northeast. The smoke is expected from Ohio to Wisconsin, with some possible over Philadelphia, Chicago, and Minneapolis. It'll keep heading south Friday into more of the Midwest, Appalachia, and the East Coast while things start to improve in the north. Storms forecast for Saturday in the upper Midwest and Northeast could help clear things up. Wildfire smoke can be very dangerous for sensitive people, like the very young, the elderly, and people with health conditions. I'm Michael Kastner.
Taco Bell is now reportedly being investigated as a possible source of the growing cyclosporiasis outbreak. A report initially in the Washington Post said the outbreak of the illness may be tied with lettuce and other items to Taco Bell food. In recent days, signs appeared in Detroit area Taco Bell restaurants notifying customers the locations could not serve lettuce, cilantro, onions, pico de gallo, or guacamole because of a national recall. There are now nearly 7,000 cases of that stomach bug across 34 states. And meantime, Michigan health officials are also urging residents to avoid bagged lettuce and salad mixes to lower the risk of that illness. The parasitic infection is causing thousands of people, again, in at least 34 states, to develop nausea. Over 5,000 cases have been reported, over 3,000 in Michigan alone. The Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration say they're still investigating several outbreaks, most likely linked to fresh produce. And the aunt of the teen who died after being thrown from a horse-drawn carriage in Central Park, telling the city council no family should ever have to go through what they went through.
It's time now to pass the law and not let anyone in this world suffer what our nephew Roman suffered.
At a public hearing that lasted some 6 hours, relatives pleaded with the city council to pass proposed legislation to ban the horses permanently. The bill would phase out the longtime horse carriage industry in New York City in 2 years by June of 2028. And Frontier Airlines passengers will soon be able to use Wi-Fi. The airline says that starting early next year, flights will offer high-speed internet through SpaceX's Starlink. Beyond watching movies on a flight, the airline says Starlink will also provide connectivity for pilots, flight attendants, maintenance teams, and ground operations. Pricing, though, has not yet been announced. Finally, in our news segment at 13 minutes past the hour, the defending champs are back in the World Cup final. Argentina defeating England 2-1 in the last semifinal matchup from Atlanta yesterday. Lionel Messi's squad will face Spain from New Jersey, and that will take place on Sunday. It is a Thursday morning. It is July 16th. We appreciate your listenership here on EWTN. Check out all of our great resources at EWTN.com. Since it's a Thursday, you know what that means. Cultural Connections with Father Mitch Pacwa up next. Minutes past the hour on Thursdays, we chat with our very own Father Mitch Pacwa about cultural issues and call it Cultural Connections, two segments. So, Father, thank you. Always great to have you on the program. And I know there's lot of concern being raised by conservatives and others and different, especially faith-based communities, about types of folks that are getting elected. And my concern is that a lot of people may not even, who are voting for these folks, may not even be aware of whom they're for whom they're voting. If you go around, you ask people, well, why are you voting for this person? Their response seems to be, well, they're going to tax the wealthy. They're going to give us free stuff. They're going to give us free grocery stores. They're calling themselves democratic socialists, which is really another name for communists. This is very alarming. Why do you think so much of this is happening?
I think there are a couple things going on. One of them is that you have to look at the people running for the Social Democrat offices. I mean, he's failed now with Graham Plattner, but certainly with Mr. Mamdani in New York. These are people who come from very wealthy families. They have been living off of the wealthy. Have these endowments. Ro Khan is another one. He's living off of the wealth of his wife's father. And his kids have these trust funds. And that's why they call them trust fund babies. They have a good number of them have lived off of trust funds. And this idea of living off of the wealth of people who got it earlier than they and not doing anything, they don't work in the corporations that they live off of. They just live off. That is their model. That's how they grew up. And this is their model of how it's done. They want the whole society to do the same. Go to work when you feel like it. I'm not trying to exaggerate something. This is one of the proposals that is coming out of the Democratic Socialists. They are saying you have a 30-hour work week, if you don't feel like going into work, you don't have to. Just work as much as you need to. They take Marx's line, contribute as much as you can, and take what you need. This is an incredibly naive perspective because people will take more than they need. Good example of that would be during the past 60 years where I've seen rioting in which people break into stores. They take out a number of things from stores that they can't possibly all use. Mm-hmm. Maybe they can sell them, but they can't use more than one television, probably. They don't need more than one, but they take it. This is a good example of what will happen. And the idea of working for 30 hours a week, that will reduce the number of products mm-hmm. and increase the prices as a result. Right. Even in mm-hmm. a socialist system, supply and demand mm-hmm. really come into play. This is a tremendous naivete that only works if you are a trust fund baby. You can take out of your trust fund as much as you want. They can't model all of society that way. I think a second problem, and this is inherent to all socialism, and people need to read Thomas Sowell, who was a communist and studied hard. He's a brilliant economist, was himself a communist, and realized this cannot work. It's not just that, there are a few failures. No, this system cannot work. And he and another economist named Friedrich Hayek, I want to urge our listeners to read Hayek. There's a great book. I think it's called The Road to Serfdom. This is just brilliant. He studied both the National Socialists in Germany, that is the Nazis, and he studied the Communists in Soviet Union back during the pre-World War II and during mm-hmm. the war and after. And he saw the same problem, and Thomas Sowell sees it, and Walter Williams and others, that you center too much of the economy in too few hands, because you can't vote on every economic decision with the whole population. No, you, in a socialist system, very few people make the decisions. And what happens with that is, as it does with corporations who become too short-sighted, that you always overlook key factors in the economy. And this is what messed up the economy of the Soviet Union, as well as all the Nazis. They had this, as an example, Nazis had put their industrial might into making war machinery. The problem is they don't have any oil wells in that part of Europe, and they were unable to conquer the oil wells of Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, or Russia. And so they ran out of oil. You can't plan for all these things. You have to let an economy keep adapting to each need, and people within the economy outside of government will come up with clever ways of resolving these problems. But if you put it all in the hands of government leadership, they always forget, oh, yeah, we got to have oil. And we have to have the right kind of oil. Hitler didn't, you know, deal with the mechanics who knew that when they were in Russia, they needed a different grade of oil for the cold weather than what they gave them. He decided in his apparatchiks, decided what kind of oil they needed for their machinery, and they stopped in the cold because it was the wrong kind of engine mm-hmm. oil. It's that kind of little detail that loses wars, but it also loses economies. And that's what, you know, folks think. These people are so smart, they'll be able to figure it out. No.
Right.
Sweetheart, you have to figure it out with other people who know what they're doing, and we as a consuming and producing society figure it out better than any government can. Mm-hmm. This is
But Father, it's not
crucial.
Like we haven't had examples, as you just pointed out, of it not working over and over and over again.
The classic example, what was the purest example of Marxism in Europe during the Cold War? It was Albania.
Mm-hmm.
They also became the poorest country in all of Europe. Their economy was the absolute lowest. They were the Haiti of Europe, economically speaking. And this is something people don't study. These economies and the effects of economy. That's why I'm saying read Thomas Sowell.
Let's pick this up, Father, on the other side of the break, talking with Father Mitch Pacwa, our cultural connections, on a Thursday. We'll be right back. Thursday, July 16th. Appreciate your listenership here at EWTN's Catholic Connection. Always appreciate the great wisdom and insight of our very own Father Mitch Pacwa. Father, we were talking during the break about how we're still very surprised about what's happening, especially on the East Coast, even though that area is notoriously very liberal. I still was surprised that Mondani got elected, given the high number of Jewish Americans living there. But my understanding is, according to our mutual friend Bill Donahue, that many of them are secular Jews and that they were raised in the faith, but they don't practice it. And they're not all that concerned with, I guess, these different types of issues, because why would you elect someone like that? Just put everything else aside, the lack of experience, political experience.
Well, what concerns me about the Jewish vote is the negative attitudes that we hear expressed toward Jews. This is really serious, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the rise in anti-Semitism is an issue of crime. This is extraordinarily serious, and that the Jewish community has been seeing that increase, and I would hope that they would seek more protections for their own members. You know, again, that this is something that you just can't vote people who are, you know, potentially anti-Semitic and anti-Christian too. This is going to definitely be an ongoing problem. But I think people don't come out and vote in primaries. That is one of the key issues here. And we can't afford to let that keep on happening, that people need to get out in the primaries and to pay attention to a lot of what looks like small local issues. Your library board, your school mm-hmm. board.
School board.
All of those, these are all important issues. We need to be involved. And to get involved in something like a library board is important because it trains a voting group to deal with these various issues. You can learn mm-hmm. how these politics work. But that's another issue. One of the things I would like to mention in this regard, I'm sure you've seen, and I hope other people see, that the platform of the Democratic Socialists is being brought out. Mm-hmm. In their platform, one plank is to get rid of the U.S. Senate, mm-hmm. because they say that votes for the rich. Again, this is where education comes. That's not what it does. It protects the small states and the less populated states, say like Wyoming or Montana and Idaho, as well as Delaware and Rhode Island. It protects the less populated states from being dominated by the more populous ones. If they get rid of the Senate, there will be a few ways to prevent the highly populated states like California, New York, Texas, and Florida from dominating the other states and what they do. So that's an issue. This goes to the core of what I was saying before. Just as they do not have a way of thinking about enough of the economy, they don't include enough issues in the economy, we see that they will have a similar problem because when did they have a convention that mm-hmm. put out for people to see and give them the reasons to see that we should not have a Senate? Where do they talk about that?
Well, even on their website, small group if you just go on their website, it's very generic and it sounds very good and it doesn't sound good, but you know what I mean? They're making it sound, you know, very ethical and we care about the little people and the working people and capitalism is bad because it pits us against one another. And so they give you these emotional, you know, tweaks here and there. But right underneath it is all socialism and communism. But I don't see an actual platform that lists the various planks specifically on their website, which is dangerous.
Well, But that's why I'm bringing this up about the Senate. It's not just getting rid of the Senate without taking into account the reasons for it to exist. It is the fact that just a small group of people inside that party came up with this. They did not vote among their membership, whatever membership they have. They didn't vote for this. They decided in a tiny group. That's exactly what I mean they will try to do with the economy. So it's a way of them thinking that is inherently dictatorial. They are dictating this idea of having no Senate so they can get more control through the House and getting rid of the president and the Supreme Court. And they didn't ask the people of the United States, do you think that this is all, you know, we have to get rid of all these things? That they just made that decision. We have to see in that these are dictators in the making. They didn't give good reasons for getting rid of the Supreme Court presidency or Senate, and therefore our whole Constitution. And they will not give good reasons for the changes that they make when they are the dictators.
Right.
That is going to be, this is a model for how they would govern if you let them come into place. And this is what people need to highlight. And so this has been the story of all of communism and the National Socialists were the same way. And the difference between socialism and communism is that in socialism, the government owns the means of production. In communism, they own everything. So, for instance, when they say we will guarantee housing, how will they do that? They will confiscate ownership of everybody's house, and they will force people to move out of some houses so that others can move in. They will take possession not just of the means of production, the factories and refineries, but they will also take possession of all private property. That is implied in their promise for housing.
Yes. And we have to do our homework, and we have to understand for whom we're voting and why, and we have to make sure that we are up to date. Father, great discussion, important insights. We appreciate you, and we will talk to you again next week, God willing. We'll be right back on a Thursday. Stay tuned. There's a beautiful new and very important guide for young people to help them navigate life's most important relationships, beginning with the relationship with God and then with each other. It's entitled You Can't Love Forever, published by our friends at Ignatius Press. It's an essential read for anyone seeking to understand the church's teachings on love and marriage, especially those who are considering marriage. So what a great gift this would be for someone in your household, your circle of family and friends who may be engaged, getting married soon, even for those who are in marriage ministry at your parish, your pastor, your deacons, just a great resource for all of us who are interested in helping young people navigate these important decisions. To discuss this new resource is Emily Dineny, and she is a young Catholic influencer. She also works with Catholic Answers. Of course, we run the wonderful Catholic Answers Live every day here at EWTN at 6 p.m. Eastern. Emily, great to have you on board. I know you have a lot of background in marketing and social media. Why is this book so important for young people? What do you think? Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Teresa, for having me on. So I would say, you know, we live in a culture that's hypersexualized, and the church, our response should not be no response. It should be for us to correct with charity how God truly designed us and designed sexuality and marriage. And so we live in a day and age where people don't really have a purpose for dating anymore. People don't really see marriage as something beneficial, and they see it as outdated. And so this book does a wonderful job asking, you know, different priests, married couples, theologians, young lay people all around the world about these, you know, kind of questions that aren't really explicitly talked about. Like, you know, for example, can you choose your gender? Is casual sex okay? Well, how do I know if he or she is the right one? Really, I like to think of this book as like if you had an older sibling that you would kind of confide in and ask your questions about as you're kind of navigating the dating world and married life. That's exactly what this book provides for young people.
So you have quite a following on social media, more than 100,000 followers across various platforms. What are young people telling you, Emily, in terms of their concerns, especially with faith and relationships, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think I see a lot of despair at times because people find it really hard, even in the Catholic world sometimes, to find an individual that's dedicated as well to chastity and purity before marriage and, you know, follows the church's ethical guidelines on like being open to life and being against IVF and surrogacy and abortion. So I think that some people, young people, they're struggling to find people, especially in the West, that kind of embody the church's morality. And yet I do encourage people, you know, the Lord is faithful and he will provide. It might take a little bit of waiting. It might come up in a way that's not what you anticipated or initially expected. You know, we're navigating a digital world now where you can meet people online, which is crazy. You can meet somebody from across the country or across the world that you never would have met otherwise. So we're navigating a kind of a whole new world among Gen Z, but there is hope, and I just try to encourage, you know, my fellow Gen Z, just be patient and keep praying for what you're hoping for, and the Lord will provide.
So this book is based on 1,000 questions and suggestions from young people in over 30 countries around the world. And so who addressed the questions? I understand there's a team of people who worked on this.
Yes. Yeah, so Ignatius has a UCAT team, and it consists of different priests, theologians, young lay people, and married couples from around the world, a team that they compiled and I assume interviewed to kind of decide and discern who should we include on this. And yeah, so every page really is a new question that's being asked, and there is a certain individual or couple that's answering that question for you.
So I was mentioning, I think this would be a great resource, not only for young people, but I think for anyone, obviously, in a serious relationship, looking for a serious relationship. And I think this is a great resource for all of us. So we as Catholics, because we're working or coming in contact with young people in the parish, and most of the people in this audience are very active in their faith, so they're doing something at the local level. This is, I think, something we should all be looking at.
I completely agree, yes, because, I mean, not all of us were raised in a household, you know, with a healthy Catholic marriage being embodied. And so it's super important for us to have that foundational kind of experience and understanding of what it takes to build a really healthy, good, holy marriage. And even just navigating the dating world, because like I mentioned, it's changing so much since it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And so being able to kind of accompany young people while they're on this vocational discernment and journey is so important.
Do you know, does it address the issue of AI and the influence on relationships, Emily, due to the Pope's? I know this book came out before the Pope released his first encyclical, or at least it was, you know, put together before that. But dealing with, as you said, you're a social media expert, so much of what we're dealing with today is online, including, of course, the Holy Father raising such awareness on AI.
Yes. So from my understanding, it doesn't particularly address AI, but it does talk about navigating the digital world. Like, is it okay to meet people online? How can we sort of navigate that world? You know, because I think some people's temptation, especially on online dating, is to kind of treat somebody not as a person. It's so disconnected at times. And so there definitely is kind of walking the line of like, okay, how can I use this technology, which in itself is not inherently bad, but is it good? How can I use this to fulfill God's will and plan for me? That's an important question that we need to constantly be re-examining and evaluating in our own lives.
Yeah, I can't even imagine the challenges that young people or people interested in a relationship are up against right now because of the influence of social media. But as you said, social media in general, not intrinsically evil of themselves. We all use them. We most of it has platforms on social media. The Holy Father is using it and always has. Pope Francis used social media. Benedict did. John Paul II used the internet when it became more popular during his pontificate. But it's understanding how that impacts us in terms of our relationship with God and each other. Chatting with Emily Dineny, and we're talking about this beautiful new resource published by Ignatius Press, You Can't Love Forever. What does it mean to you, Emily, to have this resource?
Yeah, I recently got married, actually, in February.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, so I'm freshly, navigating married life and, God willing, parenthood someday. And so this definitely gives me a resource for how to address kind of these questions from a Catholic perspective. I don't have any Catholic family members. My parents are not Catholic. My siblings are not Catholic. And so I don't really have, that Catholic big sister to kind of confide in and ask these questions to. So it's really helpful to kind of just have this resource. And like I mentioned, every page is a new question and all the answers are very straightforward, but they're coming from real people and different people mm-hmm. with different experiences. And so I would say it's very accessible to kind of anybody, especially for younger people.
How long have you been in the church, my dear? When did you join?
I joined in 2021, so it's been over 5 years now.
Mm. Wow. So can I ask you, I don't want you to give your whole testimony. I know you've given it before. We probably don't have time. I know it's a beautiful story, but can you let our listeners in on a little bit of your journey into the Catholic Church?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So when I was a teenager, I was invited to this Wednesday youth group night at a non-denominational church. And I would have considered myself Christian growing up, but religion was never a big part of my family. And so it wasn't until I was in middle school that I started consistently going to church. And that is when I truly would say I gave my life to Christ and in trying my best to live after him. And so I did that for 3 years. And when COVID hit, I couldn't go to church anymore. I was living in Southern California at the time, so everything was super strict. And so I started to immerse myself in online Christian communities. And that's where I was exposed to this whole new world of so many different denominations and differences in theology. So that really caused me to face the question of, well, how do I know what I believe is right and all of these other people are wrong? And so by the grace of God, that led me into meeting a Catholic and questioning the Catholic Church and researching the early church fathers and the history of the Protestant Reformation. And I realized pretty quickly that the Catholic Church was true and I needed to join it. So I enrolled in OCIA and then, I was brought into the church officially when I was 18 years old. And
wow.
It's been 5 years now, which is crazy, but it's flown by.
What led you to work for Catholic Answers? How did that happen?
I know, it's crazy. I started my own social media platform when I was 18 just to kind of show people, hey, like, here's what I believe. And I had no idea that it would ever take off. I just wanted to engage with other people that maybe were in a similar boat as me of like, oh, I just was, used to this non-denominational world, but I don't know what Catholics believe. And so I was trying to kind of put that out there and it started to grow. And eventually I was connected with Gary Machuda, who had me
Michigan,
on his radio show at the time.
I know Gary really well. He's great. Great apologist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was through him that I was able to connect with Catholic Answers and start writing for them a little bit on their magazine and blog. And I built that relationship with them. And then, I was looking for a job and I reached out to them and they were like, well, we would love to hire you if you would want to work for us. And I was like, that's my dream. So,
let me think about that.
Okay,
2 seconds later, the answer is yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. I just think it's awesome. And I think converts help we cradle Catholics in really improve on our own knowledge of the faith. I love following a lot of these Protestants. You've probably seen it because you're a social media influencer. You've probably seen a ton of them. And I'm sure because of my algorithms on the different feeds that I follow, they keep sending me the same types of things. But there's a lot of young non-denominational Christians who are slowly making their way to the faith, and they have similar questions that you had, Emily. And that's why I think this is so helpful to have a resource like you, Kat, to have people like you who are young, who are dynamic, who can explain the faith. But that journey of questioning is so important, is it not? Which falls right into the category of this book.
Yes, I 100% agree. You know, our pursuit of the Lord is really this journey and this adventure. And Jesus says that he is the way, he is the truth. And so I always encourage people to ask their questions, to pursue the truth, because ultimately when we pursue the truth, we ultimately find Christ. And questions can be of any topic, really. But I think when it comes to the topic of dating, of relationships, of our vocation, that's one of the most important ways that God is going to use us and form us and bring us closer to heaven and make us saints. So it's so important to be asking these questions and to trying and to really put in the effort to pursue our vocational calling as best as possible in the light of what the church teaches.
So do you know, in addition to this wonderful resource in the book, will there be any type of online catechesis available to walk folks through the book, especially if they're in a teaching capacity at the parish or the diocesan level? Emily, are there any plans in the works right now, do you know?
You know, I believe that throughout the book, actually, there's some QR codes that you can scan, and they do have some sort of interactive content that you can find throughout the book. I'm not quite sure about if they're going to develop like a full-blown course for it, but I do know that they try to make it interactive, yes, for people who are learning about this maybe in a catechetical setting.
So how big is the book physically? Because if you have 1,000 questions, that's a lot of material, my dear.
I know. It's really not that big. I would probably say close to around 300 pages.
Well, that's not bad.
It's super accessible. And, you know, as I've mentioned, the church obviously talks a lot about love and family life and things like that. But encyclicals are not always the most accessible document, especially to like a 16-year-old, you know. And so having a book that's really just a question and a straightforward answer, it's so, so needed in today's world, and I would say it's very accessible to anyone, really, who is, you know, late teenager onward.
Or young at heart like me.
Exactly.
All right, my dear. God bless you. Thanks for all your great work, especially on social media. Our wonderful guest, Emily Dineny, and she is talking about this beautiful new resource, UCAT, Love Forever, published by Ignatius Press and available, of course, at the EWTN Religious Catalog. We'll be right back. Don't forget, you can get your own copy of UCAT, Love Forever, at the E.W. Chan Religious Catalog or through Ignatius Press and other sources. We hope you check out our wonderful religious catalog, though, first. We'd appreciate that. We'd also appreciate if you stay tuned to hour number two of Catholic Connection on EWTN's Radio Extra. We are going to be chatting with the one, the only, Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. We're going to be discussing the cause for canonization that's being opened up for Nobel Prize winner Sigrid Undset. If you don't know her, we'll talk about her, and quite a prolific writer. And she stood up against so many evils in the world in her day, including Nazism. And she wrote many beautiful books, but she wrote a beautiful book all about St. Catherine of Siena. And that was something that I sought out because I'm a huge, huge follower of Catherine of Siena. My first favorite saint is Teresa of Avila, and pretty close second, maybe even tied in first place, would be Caterina Benincasa, St. Catherine of Siena. And it's a beautiful book, and just it takes you inside the life and the area where she grew up in Siena, and just her witness, and she just embraces everything that Catherine of Siena gave us. So we'll discuss Sigrid Undset with Michael O'Neill, and of course he is on EWTN's The Miracle Hunter every week, and just interviewed me on my new book on St. Francis, so that should be a lot of fun and very interesting, including the process of canonization. In case you're not too familiar with that, maybe you're a new Catholic or just back in the church, or maybe you just really haven't looked into it. It is a very beautiful process that the church does in terms of considering whether someone should be moving up the ladder toward canonization. And then during our 2 cent segment, our gospel for today, I wanted to highlight what our Lord is telling us about his yoke being easy and his burden light. What does that mean? We'll explore in 2 cents. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
Thanks for tuning in to hour number two of Catholic Connection on EWTN's Radio Extra. It is a Thursday, July 16th, moving quickly through this week of July. And we have a great second hour for you as well. Coming up in 2 cents, I don't know if you actually did your readings or today. I'll share the gospel with you and talk about, you know, my perspective on the gospel, and especially when Jesus tells us, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." It really is beautiful when you understand the meaning of yoke in terms of what it represented. And whenever our Lord spoke, he spoke in ways people can understand. He spoke in parables. He gave them analogies. He talked about fig trees. He talked about fruit. He talked about wine and things to which people could relate in his day and age. They were farmers. They were people who worked, you know, with their hands. And so he always tried to get them to understand the kingdom of God and salvation from images to which they could relate. And this is one of them. And it's a biggie. And it's something that really took hold of me when I came back into the church. And then even after that, when I was still struggling and trying to figure out what God wanted me to do with my life, because I was pushing in the opposite direction, going against the yoke, as they say. So we'll discuss in 2 cents. And then looking forward to our interview with Michael O'Neill. Of course, he is known as the Miracle Hunter, and we are going to be discussing the process of canonization, in particular for Nobel Prize winner Sigrid Undset, which just was announced that they're opening up the cause for canonization. Now, it's a very, very long process, and there's a long step where they're venerable, blessed, and it's just there's several steps involved, and we'll have Michael explain. And we'll also get some information about this wonderful, possibly soon-to-be, who knows, saint. We'll see. It's in God's hands, and we'll learn more about it from Michael O'Neill. So that is the second hour of Catholic Connection. Appreciate your listenership again, as always. Make sure you check out our great work, all of it online, on TV, on radio, EWTN.com. Weather-wise, well, it's not a very pretty picture. The National Weather Service is saying we have flash flood risk continuing in Texas and wildfire smoke in a number of different areas across the country. So we have life-threatening, considerable flash flooding expected in south central Texas. Now that's through tomorrow, and they're saying at least Friday, so it could go into the weekend. They have catastrophic river flooding and rapid rises on small streams, and typical dry washes are expected in the Texas Hill Country as well. And then we've got this issue in several areas, and we'll have a story about it in the news, of wildfire smoke impacting air quality across so much of the Great Lakes into the Northeast, and we have air quality alerts in several areas as a result. So that's a look at the forecast for most of the good old U.S. of A. Right now, though, it's 3 minutes past the hour, and we do have a ton of news to get through for you. So let's get started with the news here on EWTN Radio Extra. The French National Assembly giving final approval yesterday to a bill legalizing euthanasia and assisted suicide. As EWTNnews.com reports, this makes France one of the few European countries to legalize a practice, along with Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Spain. The 291-241 vote came 3 years after President Emmanuel Macron had made it one of his key campaign promises, first opening the question to national debate. The vote ending an unusual parliamentary stalemate between the National Assembly and the Senate. Members of the National Assembly passed the bill 3 times over the course of 14 months, most recently in late June by a vote of 295-232, and senators rejected it just as many times. Now, the July 15th vote yesterday, though, did not close the matter. Officials say the council must rule within a month or 8 days if the government asks for expedited review, meaning the law cannot be promulgated until that review is complete, even though the Assembly has now adopted it. And President Trump's pick to oversee the Justice Department grilled on Capitol Hill yesterday, Senator John Cornyn of Texas pressing Todd Blanche on whether he will go after the makers of the abortion pills.
This ought to be a pretty easy call, because women are hurt as a result of side effects.
Senator Cornyn also asked if Todd Blanche would, if he gets the job, if he wants to see an effort to crack down on access to the pill, because Cornyn says it's a dangerous pill, especially without a doctor's visit.
incomplete abortion, other complications when this is being sold through the mail.
Blanche calling Trump the most pro-life president in U.S. history, saying that federal health leaders are taking a hard look at the abortion pills, but he did not go into litigation strategy. He will be back in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee today as it considers his nomination to be the next U.S. Attorney General. New South Carolina Republican Senator Darlene Graham meeting with President Trump at the White House today. She was appointed to take over the seat of her brother, Senator Lindsey Graham, who died unexpectedly over the weekend. Later in the day, the president will welcome the leader in El Salvador to the Oval Office. And tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, he will deliver an address to the nation about election integrity. The president also announcing a large investment in national security as the U.S. conducts new strikes on Iran. Speaking Wednesday at the Pennsylvania Defense and Innovation Summit, he touted a $10 billion investment in Pennsylvania's defense industrial base. He said the state will play a key role in what he called building the arsenal of freedom. And just before he took the stage, U.S. Central Command announcing it had begun an additional round of strikes on Iran, Trump reiterated that previous presidents should have taken action on that country. Mark Mayfield tells us more than 100 House Democrats voting to stop aid to Israel yesterday, and it's a huge shift in support for the U.S. ally.
An amendment to a State Department funding bill introduced by Republican Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie would have slashed aid for Israel by $3.3 billion. It failed 314 to 104, but left the Democratic Party strongly divided after anger over Israel's conduct in its war with Gaza. Only 37 Democrats voted for a similar measure 2 years ago. I'm Mark Mayfield.
And life-threatening flash flooding, as we mentioned in the forecast earlier, pounding parts of Texas. Here's Governor Greg Abbott, who says he's declared a state of emergency across 59 counties.
We are dealing with and responding to a flood that is likely going to break records in Texas history. Our primary focus right now and throughout the remainder of this torrential rain is saving lives.
The National Guard and other state resources activated ahead of the storms. Dozens of water rescues have already been carried out in hard-hit Uvalde County alone. And over in Colorado, the Aspen Acres fire in the southern part of that state is now the fifth most destructive wildfire in state history. Incident Commander Jake Livingston said firefighters are working to keep the fire away from more than 200 structures near Lake Isabel and Camp Jackson.
We're making progress, but there's still a lot of potential right now in this fire if the right conditions show up for fire behavior. So a lot of potential to impact homes from Lake Isabel all the way down to Rye.
More than 850 structures have already been destroyed by that fire, including more than 330 homes. The Aspen Acres fire continued its slow growth this week, moving to just under 100,000 acres with 36% containment as of yesterday. And Michael Kastner tells us about wildfires burning in Canada and Minnesota that are causing major air quality issues across large sections of the country.
The smoke was dense and hazy Wednesday from Minnesota to Michigan and upstate New York and further into the Northeast. The smoke is expected from Ohio to Wisconsin, with some possible over Philadelphia, Chicago, and Minneapolis. It'll keep heading south Friday into more of the Midwest, Appalachia, and the East Coast while things start to improve in the north. Storms forecast for Saturday in the upper Midwest and Northeast could help clear things up. Wildfire smoke can be very dangerous for sensitive people like the very young, the elderly, and people with health conditions. I'm Michael Kastner.
And Taco Bell is reportedly now being investigated as a possible source of that growing cyclosporiasis outbreak. A report initially in the Washington Post saying the outbreak could be tied with lettuce and other items in Taco Bell food. In recent days, signs appearing at Detroit area Taco Bell restaurants notifying customers locations could not serve lettuce, cilantro, onions, pico de gallo, or guacamole because of a national recall. There are now nearly 7,000 cases of the stomach bug across 34 states. Meanwhile, Michigan health officials are urging residents to avoid bag lettuce and salad mixes to lower the risk of that that illness in the stomach and intestines. The parasitic infection is causing thousands of people, as you just heard, in 34 states to develop nausea, fever, and severe diarrhea. Over 5,000 cases reported, 3,000 in Michigan alone. The CDC and FDA say they're investigating several outbreaks linked to fresh produce. And the aunt of the teen who died after being thrown from a horse-drawn carriage in Central Park is telling the city council no family should ever have to go through that type of a situation again.
It's time now to pass the law and not let anyone in this world suffer what our nephew Roman suffered.
At a public hearing that lasted 6 hours, relatives pleading with the city council to pass proposed legislation to ban the horses permanently. Now, the bill would phase out the longtime horse carriage industry in New York City by June of 2028. It includes a program to help carriage workers transition to other jobs. Those in favor of the bill testified they're concerned about safety. The union representing carriage drivers opposed the bill. They told the city council the tragedy is being exploited and they want safety changes instead. A vote on the measure will take place next month and it's expected to pass. Scott Carr tells us the House Homeland Security Committee is requesting a brief meeting with ICE next week.
Republican Congressman from New York, Andrew Garbarino, who chairs the committee, tells The Hill his panel's already reached out to ICE for details on the status of its implementation of body camera requirements for officers. That request comes after ICE officers fatally shot two individuals over the past week. Garbarino notes the briefing will not touch on those shootings as the FBI is investigating both of them. Both men were inside their cars when federal officers shot them, prompting ICE to temporarily pause traffic stops. In a post Wednesday, President Trump said federal immigration agents are not ending traffic stops. I'm Scott Carr in Washington.
And it's the hottest time of year, and a doctor is raising awareness about dehydration in seniors. Dr. Ronan Fectora with the Cleveland Clinic saying seniors have less water in their body because the amount goes down as you get older, so seniors simply cannot afford to lose as much as the rest of the population.
Don't overdo it. You know, the work is always going to be there. You don't want to be in a situation where you suffer heat stroke, you get dehydrated, and you end up in the hospital, because for people who are older, that can end up with a lot of different complications.
Also, some older folks may take certain medications that can make it harder for their body to regulate temperature and recognize thirst. The doctor emphasizing seniors should drink a lot of water throughout the day and take breaks from the heat. Stats show dehydration is one of the top causes for hospital admission for older adults. And Monica Nelson tells us there's a new warning from economists and artificial intelligence experts saying governments and businesses need to prepare now for the rapid rise of AI.
Researchers from Stanford University's Digital Economy Lab have released an open letter signed by more than 200 economists and AI experts, including 16 Nobel Prize winners. The group says artificial intelligence could become dramatically more powerful over the next decade, creating major economic benefits while also putting some jobs at risk. The researchers are urging policymakers and industry leaders to establish some safeguards and policies that ensure AI works alongside people and benefits society as a whole. I'm Monica Nelson.
And Frontier Airlines passengers will soon be able to use Wi-Fi. The airline saying that starting early next year, flights will offer high-speed internet through SpaceX's Starlink. Beyond watching movies on a flight, the airline says Starlink will also provide connectivity for pilots, flight attendants, maintenance teams, and ground operations. Pricing has not been announced yet. It's a Thursday morning. We appreciate you. We'll be right back with our 2 cents, taking a look at why our Lord's yoke is easy and indeed his burden is light, as it says in the gospel today. Welcome back, Catholic Connection. It's 17 minutes past the hour. It is a Thursday morning already. My goodness, time flies, especially when you have great guests. And we have the Miracle Hunter, Michael O'Neill, joining us in the next two segments after our 2 cents segments. He is going to be talking about a cause for canonization being opened up for Sigrid Undset. It's very exciting, and she's a wonderful novelist and has contributed so much to the literary world, but also stood up for the faith and so many people who were vulnerable. And we'll talk about why she could be a saint. You never know. It's a long process, a very detailed process, but a very important one. And in the Archdiocese of Detroit, we're still waiting for Blessed Solanus Casey to become a saint. And we're hoping that that is right on the corner. We just keep praying, and we also ask for their intercession. Okay, Love the gospel for today. I didn't really understand it for a long time until I did some research. And when I did some research, I was writing my book, God's Bucket List. And this came out, gosh, God's Bucket List, probably 10 years ago. And I thought about this in terms of the fact that, okay, God has a bucket list for us. He doesn't have his own bucket list. He's God, right? He doesn't need anything. But he has a bucket list for us. In other words, the top things that he knows are going to make us happy and joyful, even if we don't understand it in the beginning. All right. And the first and foremost at the top of that list is our relationship with him in the one holy Catholic and apostolic faith. All right. So the gospel for today, Matthew 11, 28 through 30. Jesus said to me, "Come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am meek and humble of heart, and you will find rest for yourselves. For my yoke is easy and my burden light." All right, so what in the world is the Lord talking about here? All right, well, let's look at the meaning of yoke first of all, okay? So the literal meaning, it's a wooden beam, and you've seen pictures of this, I'm sure, placed over the necks of two animals, often oxen, and it joins them, allowing them to work together, such as plowing or pulling a cart. So as I said, going into this segment in the hour number two, this practical use was very familiar to first century Jews who were farmers. They could understand this, okay? So in Scripture, it usually symbolizes connection and partnership, joining two entities for a common purpose, such as two oxen working together. It can also refer to, and this is a biggie, obedience and submission, accepting God's guidance and will, as in the yoke that he's giving us. My yoke is easy and my burden light. And a shared burden, carrying life's challenges together with God rather than alone. From a more Catholic perspective, a Catholic reflection often frames our Lord's yoke as his yoke, the yoke of Christ, a call to humble, self-giving service. St. Augustine likened it to a bird's wings. Removing the yoke would make the bird unable to fly, just as removing God's yoke would hinder our mission. All right, and this finally clicked for me when I was making my way out of the secular media into Catholic media, and here's why. When I had that very powerful experience, and I told you about this, I think last week or the week before, when I had come back to the church and Deacon Dom and I were learning about the faith, we were reading everything, we were very hungry, basically kind of like born-again Catholics, and we couldn't get enough of the teachings. We were in Bible study, we were back at church, we were joining different ministries, and so we were super on fire for the Lord. And I was still working in the secular media at that time, and I was at one of my most important positions at a big ABC affiliate, working as a news reporter, a top street reporter there, live on the air every day. And at the same time, I noticed the closer I was getting to the Lord and the more I was growing in my faith, the more I felt uncomfortable in the secular media. I'm not saying that working in the media is bad. I still work in the media. I have a lot of friends who work in the secular media. There are still good people in it, even though, of course, we know they have a lot of issues, especially in terms of a lack of balance and sensationalism. That's for another day. But I didn't know how to do anything else. That's my degree. I have a journalism degree, a minor in broadcasting. I was on the air at that point for about 20 years. I didn't know that I could do anything else. And so I was very, very confused. And when the Lord, when I felt that voice in my heart of the Lord saying, "I can't use you in the secular media anymore," instead of saying, "Okay, show me," I said, "Well, I didn't hear correctly. Maybe it wasn't God. Maybe it was something else. Maybe it was my imagination." But what I was really struggling with was my own ego, my own doubt, my own confusion as to how could I do anything else but news reporting? That's all I know. And I kept pushing against it, going against the yoke, and it was such a struggle. I left TV, went into radio. I thought, okay, I'll be happy here. I can still stay on the air. I can get back doing radio news. It's fairly simple. and I can, you know, do my own thing and still grow in my faith. And at the same time, I was still running into all sorts of issues, because at that point in radio, things were changing dramatically. There were all these federal laws that were allowing more ownership of different stations. So conglomerates were getting bigger and bigger, cutting down on quality broadcasting. News was being eliminated or drastically trimmed on a regular basis. And so again, I was trying to fit in, like, what is that old saying, a square peg in a round hole, because I wasn't ready to take God's yoke upon myself in terms of, okay, Lord, whatever you want me to do, wherever you want me to steer me, I'm next to you, I'm with you, let's go. It was just the opposite. Until finally, I said, okay, Uncle, I give. And I walked away from the secular media and asked God what he wanted me to do. And as I mentioned to you earlier, and if you know anything about my testimony, that's when things really started to change. And so what I did was I accepted God's yoke for me, which was different than the yoke I had picked for myself. But when I accepted God's yoke, there was this ultimate feeling of peace that came over me. And you remember the clip we shared last week, Richard and I shared with you, with Patricia Heaton, when she was a struggling actress. And she said, okay, Lord, if you don't want me to be an actress, that's fine. I'll just continue to work in the church, whatever you want. And then, boom, things started to explode. Well, the same thing happened to me. Once I really submitted it, it wasn't just once. That first time when my husband and I healed our marriage and came back to the church, that was once. Then there was another submission. And then we have to resubmit ourselves to the Lord every single day. It's not a one-time prayer. And so when you say, okay, Lord, what is the yoke you have for me? What God's trying to tell us, I think, is that he's not going to give us this yoke as a burden. It's his will for us. He's also saying here, there's a lot in this very, very short gospel in terms of, it's not going to be all that easy. It's not going to be, you know, walk through the tulips or whatever, tiptoe through the tulips and all sunshine and roses. There are going to be struggles, but God is with us if we accept his will for our lives and we work with him, not against him. Just like Jeremiah 29:11, for I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord. Plans not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. And my favorite verse of all time, John 15:5. I am the vine, you are the branches. If a man abides in me, he can bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Accepting God's guidance and will, as in his yoke, his burden is easy. It is. Just follow him. Busy Thursday, 10:28 Eastern Time. Hope you're doing well. Love catching up with our friend Michael O'Neill from EWTN, and of course his great work and books and all the pilgrimages that he leads. We have so many things in common. We love talking to each other because we get each other, because we love to share the saints and beauty and all kinds of different churches and religious sites. But today we're tapping into Michael's great brain to talk about canonization, and more specifically, the cause of canonization for Nobel Prize winner Sigrid Undset. Michael, by the way, he really needs no introduction if you're a regular listener to EWTN. He's host of our radio show, The Miracle Hunter, on EWTN Radio, and also you see him on Explore with The Miracle Hunter and They Might Be Saints. Michael, always great to have you on the program. Good morning.
Thank you. This is big news with a Norwegian potential saint here.
Yes, and I was really excited because I was introduced to her. I'm sure you know Father John Ricardo, the great evangelist from southeastern Michigan, and he's familiar to our listeners as well. But he knows how much I love Catherine of Siena, and so he told me about the book she wrote about St. Catherine, and she had me at that book, and then I started to learn more about her. So tell our listeners about Sigrid.
Well, I think what's notable, I think, as a Nobel laureate is that when they announced her cause just opening, and of course this Bishop Frederick Hansen just announced this Everyone wants to celebrate, of course, her life and her writing. But I thought what was most notable about the announcement was that they focused on her life of virtue as a potential future saint. And I thought that was noteworthy out of the gate. They could have, oftentimes we see these saints and future saints throughout history. They've built basilicas. They've founded orders. They're kind of Catholic celebrities in a certain sort of a way. But it's so important in these causes that they focus on the virtues of the saint, of the potential saint. And I think that Bishop Hansen really was doing that with mentioning her name.
Yeah, and one of her efforts was to stand up against injustice, and she certainly wasn't shy about it, and she stood up against the Nazis as well, correct?
Correct, and I think that's part of this cause, and I think when they write the positio, the academic position paper, which sort of paints the spiritual biography of her life, that is going to be a big element of her standing up against the oppression of the Nazi regime.
So tell us a little bit more about her if people aren't familiar with her.
She's a Nobel Prize-winning author, and I think that one of the very fascinating things about her is that she comes from a place where is not known for its known as for its Catholic heritage many years ago, but of course we haven't seen saints coming from there for a while. And so she was born in Denmark, and she was raised in Norway, and she had her first books published in the early 1900s. I think 1907 was her first book. And she fled for the United States in 1940 because of what you mentioned, this opposition to Nazi Germany. And so she's best known for these trilogies, trilogy of books, The Christian Levensdatter, that's A Life in Norway in the Middle Ages. And that's probably her most famous works. And that was sort of the portrayal of a woman of that era from birth to death. So these are the works that she's best known for in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk to us about this process, because it can be a little bit confusing or overwhelming. And some people wonder, why does it take so long? In some cases, it does. In other cases, it doesn't. For example, Carlo Acutis was canonized rather quickly, if you pull back and look at the big scheme of things. Even Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, who died in the early 19th century, now that he's a saint, that's pretty quick as well, considering it happened last year. But when we open up a cause, what does that mean?
Yeah, no, I think it's good to point this out, this difference in the causes. And Carlo Acutis, for example, got the Michael Jordan treatment right after his death. His cause launched very quickly into the Holy Hall of Fame very quickly,
right.
You know. But, you know, I think that, you know, many of these saints have languished. And we don't want to use that word exactly, but it's taken centuries, perhaps, to see them canonized. And so the launching of a cause involves a local bishop giving the official approval, the stamp, for the investigation into the life of holiness of a potential saint. And so they're out of the gate with the term servant of God. And during that process, for non-historical causes, they will interview people who knew the person in their life, their relatives, their coworkers, their friends, people that were influenced by them, people who received some sort of an intercession or a healing through them. Any kind of knowledge they can get about that potential saint, they do in this diocesan phase where it stays local, and the local bishop sort of is in charge of it. But there's a promoter, a vice postulator who works with the official postulator in Rome, the lawyer behind the cause, you might say. And then it advances to the next stage of venerable. Once they put together this academic position paper, this positio, which is submitted to Rome, reviewed by theologians, and eventually this dicastery for the causes of saints will make the recommendation to the Pope that says, okay, this person, based on the positio, all these interviews, all this research, has truly lived a life of heroic virtue. And then the Pope will promulgate a decree saying that they're venerable. And at that point, and at that point only, the search for miracles is on. They can obviously look for older miracles that have happened, but only until a person is venerable, and that's my favorite part when they talk about miracles, of course, as the miracle hunter, but miracles through the singular intercession of that potential saint lead to blessed, then a subsequent miracle leads to canonization.
So there's four steps, technically.
Got it. Servant of God,
servant
venerable,
of God,
blessed,
venerable,
and saint.
Blessed, and then canonization.
Correct. That's exactly right.
And in her case, and you mentioned that because the bishop announced this, it to me sometimes it might seem like it would come from Rome, but the bishop is announcing it here.
Correct.
The fact that they're opening up the cause for canonization.
And everything starts on the local or diocesan level. Perhaps there are cases throughout history where a pope had a favorite future saint and he initiated a cause in some way or pushed it forward a little bit. But, the way that it works is it starts on the local level. And then through their research on the diocesan effort in the diocesan phase, then that moves forward to Rome when the positio is handed over to the dicastery.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's a beautiful quote from the bishop. She showed a constant and practical concern for the poor. She gave of herself in caring for her daughter and her commitment to life and to the sanctity of life. Through her many books, she has shaped countless believers, inspired them to live in Christ, and borne witness to our medieval saints. I'm not sure if many people know about her love for the saints, because as I said, I was introduced to her mainly by my friend Father John Ricardo and mm-hmm. the Catherine of Siena book that she wrote.
Yeah, that's the big biography of the 14th century Saint Catherine of Siena, and mm-hmm. that was a big one in 1951 that she published. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I think for a lot of people, they may not know her or see her as this Catholic luminary, but truly, if her cause is being promoted by the local bishop, they're seeing a life of virtue that needs to be explored. So, it's pretty exciting news for Norway and the Norwegians here in the United States.
What I love about our saints and hopefully a soon-to-be saint, I love the fact that they didn't have it easy. They struggled, as we all do.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the important things to remember. We all think of saints, or the common thought of saints is that we think of somebody on a holy card or a statue with a halo from across the ocean who will never be like. But these people, right. even in the United States, who walked amongst us, they had a struggle. They had becoming a saint wasn't something they were born as. It's something they became closer to God and worked with the grace of God. So there's hope for all of us, I think, is the message of the saints.
And I, as a fellow author, I love the fact that, you and I writing books and whatnot, that here we have a writer that could be a saint, which I think is awesome. And someone who I think is at least more contemporary, even though it's well over 100 years ago, more contemporary than other saints in the past who are also great writers. Michael O'Neill is our guest, the Miracle Hunter, talking about the cause for canonization of Nobel Prize winner Sigrid Undset from Norway. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour. Great to be with our friend Michael Hunter from Michael. I'm calling you Michael Hunter twice now.
You're not the
Michael,
first.
Michael the
You're
Miracle the Hunter. I'm yeah. kind of combining the whole thing.
That's right.
Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. Our topic is the canonization cause for Nobel Prize winner Sigrid Undset. Of course, Michael is a host of EWTN's radio program, The Miracle Hunter, well-known author, speaker, pilgrimage leader, and you can also see him on television exploring with The Miracle Hunter. And they might be saints. Okay, what I think is so great about this, in addition to the fact that she's a great writer, is that so many of us can relate to her. And I think sometimes that's a problem for people because, as you said earlier, Michael, we take the saints and we put them up on the shelf or we keep them in a box and we don't think that they ever struggled or we just can't relate to them. So this beautiful article written in the National Catholic Register when the announcement came out says, literary historians have noted that her life was unconventional for a woman of her time. She smoked, she drank, she swore, and she was known for a sharp tongue and a strong personality. What say you?
Yeah, no, I think, again, we have this glossy view of saints, but saints often are imperfect in so many ways, or they struggle, or they're just like regular people, you might say. So Sigrid is an example of this, someone meaning that holiness is something for everyone. We can all be saints, no matter where we've started from or what we're struggling with. I think, she's a great example of someone whose life turned around, perhaps, an unconventional life, perhaps, but she's a convert, and at some point, she was all in on her faith, and I think that's what the church is looking at, her big turnaround, yeah.
And here's another interesting point in terms of you and I were referencing St. Augustine, of course, the major turnaround he had in his life, but mm-hmm. while she was in Rome, she began a relationship with a painter while he was still married and later married him. Together, they had three children, one of whom was disabled, and she also helped raise his children from his first marriage. So it sounds like she realized that she made some mistakes and she knew she had to really address that in her own life with the Lord. And it sounds like she worked so hard to turn her life around in so many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't say this enough, but it's hope for all of us in so many ways. We all have our own struggles, our own difficulties. And that's one of the reasons I do this series, They Might Be Saints, on EWTN, and the book, They Might Be Saints. I talk about these Americans, people who walked amongst us, and, you know, they had their own struggles, their own difficulties, just like us. They're not these statue figures that we can admire from afar. They were just like us. And, you know, when saints are canonized, we all think it's kind of the Catholic Hall of Fame, and I kind of alluded to that, but really the church is holding up these people as examples and saying, look, they did it, emulate their lives and see how they, you know, walk that path to holiness, even despite all the struggles.
And this is interesting, a fascinating fact, that she admired G.K. Chesterton and even met him and translated some of his work into Norwegian.
Yeah, no, fascinating the influences that the saints have, and I think that's an important one, of course, the great writer that he was as well. So you never know what pushes the saint along the path to sainthood, and it seems like perhaps his works were pivotal in that.
So she was an early critic, I understand, of Adolf Hitler and Nazism, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And of course, that gets you into trouble when you do that. And that was very brave and courageous of her to do that. And that sort of forced her exile, so to speak, to the United States. So I think that was an important part of the legacy of Ingrid, is her standing up to Nazism.
You know, I wonder, and this is, I think, a hope and a prayer, and I think this will happen, when you mentioned it early on in the interview, Michael, that the country of Norway, and a good friend of mine is from Norway, and she's a Catholic convert. She now lives in America, but the faith is really struggling there, and it's a very dry place for Catholicism. So for Norway to make the headlines like this, I wonder for all the cradle Catholics there if this is going to inspire them to learn more about this great woman of God.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we've seen the last saints canonized something like in the 1100s or something out of Norway. So it's been a long, dry period for Norway. And hopefully this enlivens the faith for those faithful who are still there. We often wonder, what is the faith like in a place where it's dried up like that? But this can be nothing but good news for the Catholics of Norway.
So she embraced her faith in so many ways. Do you have any idea why she decided to, what attracted her to become a lay Dominican?
That's interesting. I don't know that particular fact, what caused her to do that. And of course, that is a big thing for her to do, to you know, not only just have this simple life, but to go beyond and join the Dominicans as a lay member. So I'm not familiar with that moment in her inspiration, what caused her to do that. But clearly, that was an important part of her spirituality.
Well, the thing that I find very scary, and probably why I'll never be a saint, not that I'm not working toward it, but I have a long way to go, I'm sure, as most of us do. But
yes,
they have to examine everything, right? All the writings, everything. Is that true?
Yeah, no, I think that... In so many ways, we don't want to say that anybody had an easy path to sainthood, but perhaps something like the Fatima children, they got to witness the Virgin Mary, and they lived a very short life and a holy life, and they didn't really write anything. The young children didn't, so that was kind of easy. The case of a Nobel Prize winner who is known for her prolific writing, they've got to go comb through every single thing she's ever written to make sure at a certain point, lines up to church teaching and is reflective of the life of a saint. So this cause for Ingrid is going to take a while, I think, to dig through all her writings that she's known for.
So there's really no official timetable, right, Michael? This is up to Holy Mother Church. Do we ever have any idea when we hear about that next step, or does that just depend?
No, all of it is sort of interesting, right? Because you have the four-step servant of God, and that's where we're at now. And now there's this long process, this diocesan phase, where they will comb through all her writings. So perhaps it'll take a decade, if you know, based on other people. But and then they have to find miracles, and miracles happen when God allows them to happen. So those are complicated too. So it probably will be a 10-15 years before we see some movement on this cause. But you never know. I think that in the case of Carlo Acutis, we say, why did that one move so quickly? Well, there was
and
great...
Mother Teresa was quick too. The same
yes.
thing.
Yes,
Saint Mother
there,
Teresa.
There's a certain acknowledgement by the church that certain saints are needed for a certain segment of the Catholic population, the young people, or Mother Teresa being who she was, and many people just knew of her, and it was important to work on that quickly. So with Carlo Acutis, those miracles came out fast as anybody I've seen in modern times anyway. So we'll see how it moves quickly for Ingrid as well. But they may be motivated to highlight this, given the state of the church in Norway.
So at this stage of the process, Michael, there were people who have told the bishop or told the church in Norway that they've had a profound healing or an experience through the intercession of Sigrid Undset. Would that be included in this first step of Servant of God?
So Servant of God, that is part of it, in the sense that fama sanctitatis, fame of sanctity in Latin, is important. A cause doesn't open unless there is sort of an understanding or a belief by the faithful far and wide that this person was considered to be holy. So oftentimes we equate holiness with the acts of intercession. And so when there have been instances of graces, blessings, intercessions, or even miracles, those are things that kind of push a cause forward, I think. And they all go into the sainthood file. So when it comes time to propose her as a blessed in that positio, they will dig back and look at the miracles that have been claimed and see if any can be used in that special formula, that Lambertini criteria that the Dicastery uses to look at if a miracle is instantaneous, complete, and lasting, if there's been any medical treatment that relates to the cure. So they'll hang on to these great miracle stories that push this forward to the Servant of God, and then to Venerable will be in her sainthood file generally, but then very specifically as they look at her beatification, they will look at old cases and then pray for new cases happening after the beatification.
I love our saints. They're just so amazing, and we have over 10,000 of them in the Catholic Church. What first drew you to study the saints, Michael? What was the spark for you originally?
Well, I think that it's probably predictable, but I love the fact that saints are known as great intercessors working miracles. So I've always, of course, had a great fascination and love for miracles, and that's sent me on this path of my career. But that's always inspired me in a big way, that these people are so close to God that God has favored them with the ability to work miracles here on earth, and then they're in heaven with God and they intercede for us there as well. So for me, that's always been kind of the fun aspect of the saints, is the miracles that are worked. But of course, their life of virtue is something that we can all kind of connect to the saints in a certain sort of a way. And like I say, when I wrote the book, They Might Be Saints, when I would give out that book to friends, I would tag a chapter and say, this saint, future saint, reminds me of you. Why don't you read the chapter and let me know what you think? So I think that we can connect with the saints all across the board, and it's important to find saints that resonate with us.
Well, being that we live part-time, as you know, in Umbria is known as the land of the saints, with which you're very familiar. And just recently, over the weekend, we always like to go to a different place connected with the saint that we haven't been before. And so we've been to Kasia many times for St. Rita, but we have not been to her nearby, very close by, hometown of Rocco Parena. So we went there, and that is the prettiest little place. But you talk about growing in respect and love for this great saint. You were able to see her house, you were able to see the little hospital where she worked, and you were able to see this church that's built over the rock where she prayed, which takes about 20, 30 minutes to get up to the top of the mountain, 300 steps. And she went there when life was really difficult with her children and her husband, and you have this new respect. You get this new respect when you are in their environment. Don't you find that to be true?
Oh, that's beautiful. I was just at her shrine in Kasia last year, and that is a true blessing to go to the place where she grew up and she lived.
Yeah.
I think that's really beautiful to see where the saint came from. That's amazing.
It's only like 5 miles from Kasia, and I know you lead pilgrimages, but have you ever taken a group to Rocco Parena? Because we haven't.
No, that would be something new for me, but a great one for the file. Thanks for
I think so, because I think the next time you go, next time I go, I was telling Deacon Dom, the next time we do an Umbrian tour, when we do the Umbrian saints, that's a really neat place to go, because it's doable for everybody. Most of it's flat. There's a few hills getting to her house. And there's the miracle garden, the garden of the rose, you know, where she got the rose in January from her cousin. It's so incredible. So what are you working on now in terms of your programs and your projects, and where can we learn more about Michael O'Neill, the miracle hunter?
Well, there's always new episodes of Explore with the Miracle Hunter, which you referenced as my travel series going around the world, and new episodes coming out all the time. People can go on demand on EWTN to watch those. But the project I'm really excited about is a project on stigmata. That's always I know everybody has the same reaction, because everybody, Protestants, Catholics, non-believers alike, say, well, what is that exactly? And so I did a program about the history of stigmata. Of course, we have St. Francis in the 800 years.
St. Francis
and
Laverna. Yep.
Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm. And then Padre Pio, and also Rhoda Wise is in that program as well. But I trace, you know, I love the statistics of, you know, who's getting the stigmata and who are they and how long do they last and all those things. All that data is packed into the program. So it's kind of an all-inclusive, all-encompassing special coming out on EWTN about
I think what you're doing is so important in documenting this for people, because a lot of people will see the saint or they'll roll their eyes and think Catholics are cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs and believing in all this stuff. But as you have found out, there's so much physical evidence and proof of the way they live their lives, the miracles. The church doesn't take this lightly. The church does intensive investigations.
Absolutely. I think that it's surprising to a lot of people that the church is actually interested in ruling out these wild claims of stigmata and miracles and other things. It's really motivated to suppress those things or to check them out and say, well, no, there's a natural explanation. So anytime anything passes the church's very strict criteria and makes it through recognized as a miracle, that's a little bit of a miracle in itself in my book.
Michael, great to catch up with you again. What is your main website and where do we find you in case folks want to have you speak or have you lead a pilgrimage for them? How do they reach out to you?
Yep, go to miraclehunter.com, and to get a hold of me, click on the contact tab. But for all my stuff goes through EWTN, my radio show weekly, and all my programs, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, and They Might Be Saints, and then a new series, Hidden Gems, all on EWTN.
Great speaking with you, Michael. Great explanation. And we will keep in touch, especially on this latest cause for canonization just opened up for Nobel Prize winner Sigrid Undset from Norway. We'll be right back. Thanks so much for listening to the second hour of Catholic Connection here on EWTN's Radio Extra. Teresa Tamio with you, wrapping up our Thursday morning edition. What's coming up tomorrow on a Friday? Our own Peter Gagnon, the head of our studios, will join us at 15 minutes past 9 Eastern Time in the first hour of Catholic Connection. We always discuss what's happening at the network, and we give you just kind of a preview in terms of the programming and different projects and podcasts. It's just a great way every week to get an update on all the great things we're doing. And actually, if you're a donor, you can see how much we are making your dollars work, every single one of them. Fact Check Friday, where we discuss issues in the news. That is a regular feature I've been doing for a few years. And then we're going to talk about the new film, The Odyssey, which is actually, I think it's out this weekend or starting very soon, and how it resonates with Catholics. So that should be very interesting. There's some criticism about, I was telling Richard last hour, I've been reading some stories on it, and there's been some criticism that it's way too woke and does not apply itself to the original story. So we'll discuss with Dr. Peter Deneed, and that is a program for tomorrow. Oh, we're also going to have an update on that lawsuit against Heartbeat International. The attorney representing Heartbeat is going to be joining us. Now, just think about this, if you would. We are often criticized for allegedly not caring about the women and the family overall. Okay, we just care about the baby, which is not true. But here is an organization that cares about the whole package and has been doing so for years, and yet the left says we have to sue you. Unbelievable, but it's true. Talk to you tomorrow. Have a great day.